Welcome to CapitaLink's webinar series. Today's webcast will feature Cohen and Sayers on the year ahead, MLPs, infrastructure, and closing funds. This webinar has been approved for one CFP, CPW, and one CEMA credit. We are delighted to have with us from Cohen and Sayers, Michelle Butler, Senior Vice President and Portfolio Specialist, who will be the moderator of the webinar, and our featured presenters, Doug Bond, Executive VP, Benjamin Morton, Senior Vice President. This event is accessible through a live audio webcast and then as an audio archive through www.capitalinkwebinars.com. There will be a Q&A session after the presentation. Webinar participants can submit questions through the sidebar on the presentation page titled Ask a Question or email them to questions@capitalinkwebinars.com. You can submit a question at any time during the event. The opinions expressed by the presenter is not intended as legal or investment advice or advice of any kind as a matter of fact and are provided for informational and educational purposes only. CapitaLink bears no responsibility for them. Furthermore, the presentation may contain forward-looking statements concerning future events. Please save the date for CapitaLink's 18th Annual Closing Funds and Global ETF Forum, which will take place on Wednesday, May 22nd, 2019 at the Metropolitan Club in New York City. Cohen & Sayers is a sponsor and participant of the forum. For more information, please visit forum.capitalink.com. And now I will turn the floor over to Michelle.
Great, thank you. Good morning. As Annie said, my name is Michelle Butler. I'm a portfolio specialist at Cohen and Sears, and I'm delighted to be joined today by portfolio managers Doug Bond and Ben Morton. By way of speaker introduction, Doug is the head of our closed-end fund business. He serves as portfolio manager for the Cohen and Sears Closed-End Opportunity Fund, FOF, as well as other portfolios investing in closed-end funds. Doug has a wealth of experience in the closed-end fund industry and will provide a review and outlook of the space and identify areas where we see current opportunity. Next, Ben Morton is the head of our global infrastructure team. He is a senior portfolio manager for Cohen and Sears infrastructure portfolios, including those focused on midstream energy and MLPs. Like Doug, Ben has significant expertise in his space and will discuss the investment team's outlook for global listed infrastructure and how this applies to the Cohen and Sears Infrastructure Closed-End Fund, UTF, and also the Cohen and Sears MLP Income and Energy Opportunity Closed-End Fund, MIE. With that, let's get started with a brief overview of Cohen and Sears on slide two, titled Firm at a Glance. Founded in 1986, Cohen and Sears is a global investment manager specializing in all things liquid real assets, including real estate securities, listed infrastructure, commodities and natural resource equities, as well as preferred securities and other income solutions. As of September 30th, 2018, the company had $60.1 billion in assets under management. Of that, $9.1 billion in closed-end fund assets, which is highlighted in green in the top right assets by account type chart. That's 15% of total assets, which represents a sizable portion of our business, making Cohen and Sears the seventh largest issuer of closed-end funds. Now, with that brief introduction, I'm going to pause and turn it over to Doug to dive into the closed-end market.
Great. Thanks, Michelle, and thanks, everybody, for joining us today. Slide three, which is titled Closed-End Fund Market Update and Outlook. Financial assets broadly in 2008 suffered. And that relatively poor performance in a broad array of financial assets translated to pretty poor performance for closed-end funds in 2018. It didn't matter if you owned equity closed-end funds, which were down on average about 11%, taxable fixed income funds that were down on average about 6%, or muni bond funds, which were down over 5%. You got a bit of a black eye owning closed-end funds in 2018. Our perspective on a current basis is that in terms of closed-end fund valuations, most of those major closed-end funds are undervalued relative to how the market has valued them historically. So municipal bond closed-end funds appear the cheapest to us. At the end of the year, their discounts were at 10.7% versus a long-term average of about 4%. Taxable fixed income closed-end funds also finished the year wide to their long-term average discounts. Equity closed-end funds, which spent most of 2018 actually at valuations narrow to their long-term average, finished the year about 200 basis points wide. And our view is and remains that equity closed-end funds deserve an overweight allocation in a rising rate environment where we're experiencing above-trend economic growth. The biggest offset to the relatively attractive valuations that prevail in the funds, and it's probably a risk that's sort of topmost in most investors' minds, is that the Fed has been tightening, and this Fed tightening causes rising borrowing costs, which challenge the total earnings power of the typical closed-end fund in the market, which in general, most of the closed-end funds are financing their borrowings, their leverage on the short end of the curve at rates that are sensitive to short-term movements, such as the movement in the Fed funds rate. We think selectivity is the key in the closed-end fund market to capitalize on opportunities within the equity space. We favor specific sectors that offer relative value. Either the asset class is undervalued, or the closed-end fund sector is undervalued, or both within taxable fixed income closed-end funds. Even as the discounts have moved wide to their long-term averages, we remain selective because many of the underlying asset classes that the taxable fixed income closed-end fund target are characterized by full valuations. A new issue front has been virtually non-existent for closed-end funds over the course of the last 5 years. That was the case in 2018. And that probably is a longer-term issue for the marketplace as the universe has shrunk. As there's been no new issuance, and there are currently less than 500 total funds with about $194 billion in market cap. The preponderance of the funds, about 60% of the universe, are fixed income funds, and 40% are equity funds. We turn to the next page, slide 4, titled "Closed-End Funds May Offer a Yield Advantage Over Traditional Stock and Bond Investments." The two evergreen characteristics of the closed-end fund market that continue to drive investor interest and attention is, on the one hand, the above-average yields, and on the other, the ability to buy portfolios at a discount to their book value or their net asset value. On this slide, you see on the far left of the chart, in blue, the average distribution yield for a broad measure of taxable closed-end funds encompassing equity and taxable fixed income. So in blue, the five-year average yield, 7.8%. At the end of the year, that average yield was greater than the five-year average. That's reflected in orange. It was 8.9%. And you can see a variety of different yield levels in different types of financial assets. To the right of that closed-end fund, blue and orange stack, high-yield corporate bonds, municipal bonds, treasury bonds, and the S&P 500. And for most of those groups of securities, the current yield at the end of the year was greater than the five-year average yield, reflecting the backup in most financial asset prices in 2018 and an upward move to some of those yields during the course of the year. If we turn to page 5, titled Closed-End Fund Discounts, we see the three major groupings of closed-end funds. In blue is the long-term average discount. In orange is the current discount at 12/31/18. And you can see at the far left, all equity ex foreign equity, average discount long-term 5.1%, finished the year at a 7.2 discount, actually as of last night. Discounts had come in, so the average equity discount was about 5.5%, still wide to that long-term average. In the center, you see the all taxable fixed income universe, where the long-term average valuation is a 3% discount, finished the year at a 7.7 discount. Those taxable fixed income funds have enjoyed some rally early here in January. So discounts on that group are now 5.4%, still wide to their long-term average. And then at the far right, the national and high-yield muni universe, where the blue bar indicates that long-term average discount of 4% and finishing the year at a discount in excess of 10%. Those muni discounts, like the other two groups we've mentioned, have come in somewhat this year, but they still remain very wide to the long-term average as of last night, about an 8.5% discount. If we turn to the next slide, it's just a broader view of the closed-end fund marketplace, showing current distribution yields and premium or discount to net asset value as of the end of December. And you can see in the chart at the left, the distribution yields range from the group that offers the greatest current income level, the funds focused on midstream energy, master limited partnerships with a 12.8% average distribution rate at the end of 2018. All the way to the right side, where you see the national muni group of closed-end funds with about a 5.1% distribution yield. And then on the chart on the right, reflecting premiums of discounts of these about 10 different groups, you see on the far left senior loan funds and high-yield funds with discounts both in excess of 12%. And then one of the very few groups in the closed-end fund market selling at a premium, the U.S. Hybrid group at a 4.2% premium as of December 31st. We turn to slide 7. You can see an overview of the Cohen & Steers Closed-End Opportunity Fund relative weights compared to our Morningstar benchmark. I guess for the closed-end funds, we think about this as sort of the S&P 500 of the closed-end fund market, which is a broad universe of over 300 equity and taxable fixed income closed-end funds. At the top of this slide are groups where we currently have an overweight position relative to our benchmark. At the bottom of the slide is groups where we have our greatest underweights. Those are denoted in red. The overweights are denoted in green. We mentioned early in the presentation that we felt like the municipal closed-end funds represented a tactical opportunity given the wide discounts compared to their long-term average. So that is a very large fixed income weight to the municipal closed-end funds, which is an out-of-benchmark weight for us. We also mentioned the notion that we wanted to be selective among and between the equity closed-end fund groups. So we've got the emerging market equity closed-end funds with a 540 basis point overweight, and the funds that are focused on midstream energy, MLP-focused closed-end funds at about a 500 basis point overweight position. In terms of underweight groups, the three biggest underweights for us are the covered call group, the senior loan, and the high yield group. For us, the covered call group of funds it has relatively full valuations compared to their long-term average. And in terms of the senior loan and high yield underweights, we've maintained a selective approach to where we're allocated to within taxable fixed income. And given the duration of the economic recovery, concerns we had relative to the credit cycle has led us to the conclusion to be underweight some of the more credit-intensive parts of the taxable fixed income universe, which is reflected in those underweights. So, again, most closed-end funds selling at discounts to net asset value that are wider than their long-term average, most of the groups wide to those long-term averages, and the current income levels of the closed-end fund market above their long-term five-year averages, even as the funds have rallied here in the first 3 or 4 days of January. So we still think there's value to be found in the closed-end fund market.
Great. Thank you, Doug. As a reminder, we're going to hold questions for both Doug and our next speaker, Ben, until the end of the call. I will now turn it over to Ben to jump into infrastructure and midstream.
Thanks, Michelle. Maybe I just ask if folks could move to slide 10, titled Infrastructure Offers Compelling Performance Profile. Maybe just taking a step back as you think about infrastructure, you know, what is infrastructure? What are the defining characteristics of infrastructure which lead to this performance profile that we outline here? We invest in owners and operators of infrastructure assets, companies that collect fees for usage. These tend to be regulated businesses. If they're not regulated, then they're concession-based or contracted assets. They tend to have very high barriers to entry, which often lead to, again, predictability of cash flows that comes with these characteristics. So we think of infrastructure in kind of four major buckets. Transportation infrastructure, so toll roads, airports, marine ports, railways, both freight and passenger railways, midstream energy, so the midstream portion of the energy value chain, which I'll speak in some detail about as we talk about our midstream-focused closed-end fund, telecommunications infrastructure, and that's cell tower companies and satellite companies, again, the small sleeve of the communications universe that offers predictable cash flows, given their contract structures, and then utility infrastructure, so electric, gas, water, and renewable energy. So I focus on that definition of the asset class because it's very important to sort of keep a core definition when investing to ensure that you generate the performance profile shown on slide 10. And what we show here is listed infrastructure relative to equities as represented by the MSCI World. So the first section, we show the overlap. So only about 2% on a market cap basis of the MSCI World is in what we define as infrastructure companies that offer these very specific characteristics leading to predictability of cash flows. So it is a very targeted portion of the overall equity universe. What do you get? What have you gotten over time when investing in infrastructure? That's as you move to the right in the table. Again, GLI is represented by one of the infrastructure indexes, global equities as represented by the MSCI World. We have seen equity-like returns. So here we show 6.9% for GLI versus 5.5% for equities, but with materially lower volatility. So call it, in this case, 270 basis points, lower volatility. And I'd say most important in today's context, if you think about, you know, equities up and to the right for 9 years, 9 or 10 years, if you think about fixed income offering very little in the way of income or total return, it's the downside protection, the downside capture of infrastructure, which is really what institutions around the world are focused on today when thinking about allocations to the asset class. We show here 64% downside capture. In periods when the broad equity markets are down, infrastructure has only been down 64% of the decline of the equity market. Now, depending on the benchmark you look at, that number ranges between 50 and 65%. If you look at just this period on the right, the most significant sort of market sell-off we've seen in recent history, a period in which global equities were down 18%, infrastructure defended well. It was only down about 10%, so call it just over half the decline of the broader equity market. As I noted, we've seen a ton of interest from institutions around the world in listed infrastructure, making first-time allocations to the asset class. We really believe that a lot of that relates to the fact that large institutions around the world are looking for ways to maintain some exposure to equities or equity-like returns, but in a way that they protect for the likely downside, some of which we saw late last year in, as it relates to the overall equity market. So if we look at the next slide titled Macroeconomic Impact on Infrastructure Returns, you know, we've done a lot of work to help support the case that infrastructure would perform well as we move through economic cycles and business cycles. So this work has been done in conjunction with our macro team here at Cohen and Steers, our internal team. What you see on top are relative returns of infrastructure compared to the broader equity markets in different periods within the business cycle, so recession, early cycle, mid-cycle, and late cycle. What is somewhat intuitive for a more defensive asset class is what supports the outcome here, which is infrastructure outperforms during late stages of the business cycle, as well as recessionary periods as it relates to business cycle. Those defensive characteristics, the predictability of cash flows really shine through. If you move down to the second set of charts below, we've looked at infrastructure performance relative to equities during various growth and yield regimes. Again, here, the period in which infrastructure really shines relative to equities is a period which typically coincides with risk-off market environments. It's periods in which growth is down and yields are falling. So, you know, a period in which I'd say, you know, investors were looking forward to when allocating, I'd say, over the course of the fourth quarter of 2018, when many would say we started to see greater signs of a shift in momentum as it relates to global growth and a downshift in global growth momentum, and a period in which we saw at least the 10-year Treasury yields fall in conjunction with the weakening view on global growth. So we've got our evidence based upon historical trading and performance of infrastructure that infrastructure tends to defend well during later stages of the business cycle and more risk-off market environments. Slide 12 highlights, I'd say, the second major sort of factor that's, I'd say, influencing both performance of the asset class, but then also, I'd say, interest in the asset class today. Many people think of listed infrastructure or I should say think of infrastructure and think of private allocations to infrastructure because it feels as though every week we hear about a new private infrastructure fund that's raising money to invest in infrastructure assets. Again, we invest in listed infrastructure companies, but what we show here is all of this money that's being raised in the private side is going to have an influence on listed infrastructure markets, and we'll explain why. So the top part of this slide shows the amount of dry powder that's been raised, committed capital yet to be deployed in infrastructure assets. So the truth is about twice this amount, $170 billion times two, so let's call it roughly $350 billion, has been raised by private infrastructure funds over the last several years. Now, some of that's been deployed, but those funds are still sitting on $170 billion. Now, why is that a problem? Because these funds have told their investors that they're expecting to earn an attractive rate of return on these investments. And when they sit as dry powder, they're not earning that return. What's the second reason why this is an issue? It's because there's only a finite number of deals that these private funds can invest in. And with the growing number of competitors in that space and the growing amount of capital in that space, every time a deal arises, there is a great deal of interest. And we end up in a place which is highlighted below in the table, which is we see very high multiples paid for assets. So the table below lists a handful of transactions that are spanning the globe, spanning various infrastructure subsectors, that basically show, on average, private infrastructure funds have paid north of 18 times year-ahead cash flows for infrastructure assets. Again, why is this relevant for listed? Let's tie it back into the listed infrastructure companies. First, strictly on a valuation basis, 18.5 times paid by the private funds. Listed infrastructure companies are trading at 11 times year-ahead cash flows. So a tremendous valuation discrepancy that exists between listed valuations and what private's willing to pay. So how does that filter through to our companies? Say, one, in some cases, these private transactions represent acquisitions of public listed companies in full. I'm not betting that that's what's going to be happening wholesale across the space, but we have seen even a couple of the transactions listed here represent private funds paying significant premiums for listed companies. What is more prevalent, though, is listed companies selling assets to private vehicles and private infrastructure funds. So any of our midstream companies would be very happy to sell a pipeline or enter into a joint venture for some capital with a private fund at a 15 times year ahead cash flow multiple when these companies are trading at 9, 10 times year ahead cash flows, right? That provides a very attractive valuation data point for the listed companies. So the takeaway from this slide is there's a ton of dry powder out there chasing infrastructure assets. We believe this money is and will continue to find its way into the listed markets, and that creates a very attractive sort of valuation floor and valuation support for the asset class. Slide 13 highlights one of the key questions that we get at times around listed infrastructure and a perceived risk for the asset class, and that isn't listed infrastructure sensitive to rising rates? And what we show on the left-hand side of this slide in the table is, yes, very clearly in extreme periods, and here we show the 10 periods of greatest one-month increase in the 10-year Treasury yield. In extreme periods, we do see significant negative reactions on average from listed infrastructure. Here in the period shown, on average, underperforming equities by about 250 basis points in these, again, very extreme periods of interest rate increases. Of course, that makes sense. Infrastructure businesses are capital intensive. They're quite levered relative to other parts of the broader equity market. So we're not surprised that, again, in these extreme periods, you see that kind of move. Now, what we've looked at on the right-hand side in these bar charts is the 3-month, 6-month, and 12-month periods following that extreme move. Infrastructure over all those periods has more than recouped that initial knee-jerk reaction. So why is that? First, I'd imagine that to a degree, rates probably overreacted in that period with that extreme move. So you probably saw some decline in rates, which helped the asset classes that had been most affected by that. I'd say more importantly, though, in terms of the long-term picture and why in a gradual period of rate increases, infrastructure has tended to do quite well, it's that there are elements of infrastructure that should continue to do well even in an increasing interest rate environment. And that's because we would suppose that in most of those environments, interest rates would only be increasing because economic activity, economic growth supports it. And again, there are many elements, particularly the transportation part of the infrastructure universe, that should do well in an improving a growth or at least a strong growth environment. So short term, yes, there's often a knee-jerk reaction, but the asset class, by virtue of its historical performance, as you see here, has quickly and substantially recovered that underperformance. Briefly on the fund, you'll see here ticker UTF on slide 14, leverage of around 30%, fixed leverage at 85% with a 3-year term, indicated yield at about 8%, and it's about a $3 billion fund. So moving along to our midstream focus fund and discussion, just again, as a way of backdrop, in infrastructure, in UTF, we've got a sleeve of midstream energy. We are overweight midstream in our broader, more diversified infrastructure strategy. You heard Doug mention the overweight to midstream closed-end funds. in our closed-end fund, focused closed-end fund. MIE is our midstream-focused closed-end fund, and on the next few slides, I'll explain why across the firm do we express this high conviction, overweight view in midstream. So first on 15, four key themes here. First, better business models. And as we'll talk about as we go through these next few slides, we've been talking about the transition from MLP 1.0 to MLP 2.0 for several years. But the outcome of this transition, as we say here, has meant much improved balance sheets, much better shareholder alignment, and really improved corporate governance, which was a huge issue with the traditional MLP structure, as we'll talk about shortly. Second, fundamentals are strong, and I'd say that strength is underpinned by, you know, the details of which are underpinned by infrastructure bottlenecks and pipeline bottlenecks that exist across the country and across North America, ultimately, where in certain pinch points, we've got a lack of takeaway capacity and rising production growth, which has caused significant opportunity for new investments for midstream energy infrastructure companies, which has been sort of a boost and a boon to the growth opportunity for the space overall. Major capital investment projects have been a theme, both related to some of these infrastructure bottlenecks across North America, but then also exports, which is something that has been a key theme for infrastructure investment in 2018 and will continue to be in 2019. Just this morning, a discussion around Saudi Arabia looking to invest in LNG infrastructure from North America for the first time, talking about doing that. So this will continue to be a major theme, and a lot of that relates to the need to invest in some very significant capital projects, again, both in pipelines and export infrastructure. And then lastly, similar to the theme as it relates to broader infrastructure, there has been a very targeted focus of a lot of infrastructure private equity to invest in midstream. Some of that relates to the compelling long-term investment opportunity, both based on valuations and fundamentals. Some of it relates to the fact that infrastructure businesses are diversified in terms of their regulatory oversight, which makes acquisitions, private involvement a little bit more challenging in the midstream space and a few other subsectors of infrastructure. These tend to be more commercial businesses, which means private capital can find their way into those businesses a bit easier. So we've actually seen quite a bit of activity in terms of private involvement and private acquisitions, joint ventures within the midstream space. Slide 16, it's a repeat of the analysis that we did for broader infrastructure, which takes a look at how midstreams performed across different business cycles. And clearly, there's a lot of other factors driving returns for midstream energy, energy market factors that would be the most relevant. But if you just, you know, isolate business cycle evolutions over time, we show here from January 1991 to December 2018, what we see is that the period in which infrastructure outperforms the most, or as I say, midstream energy infrastructure, similar to infrastructure overall, is the late cycle. As you see a business cycle slowdown, a transition towards a recession, which again tends to be a period in which midstream infrastructure defends well. Slide 17 again highlights the transition to 2.0, which has been an evolution over the course of the past couple of years, where we truly believe that a lot of investors have lost faith in the traditional business model. The IDR, GPL, the IDR streams created by the incentive distribution rights of being a general partner, which creates misalignment with your limited partners. We believe that 2.0 and this simplified structure, as we describe it here, with no incentive distribution rights, creates greater shareholder alignment. We've seen management teams recognize the need to reduce leverage, to live within their means and not pay out in the form of dividends and distributions more than they're earning, and actually internally finance their capital in a way that they haven't done in the past, maximizing distribution coverage versus just distribution growth. I shouldn't say maximizing distribution coverage, managing for higher distribution coverage instead of just maximizing distribution growth, creating, and we don't have it here, but creating compensation schemes for management teams that are aligned with the right things, not just distribution growth, but distribution per unit growth, et cetera, focus on return of capital. And all of this brings companies to a place where they're actually discussing stock buybacks. And obviously, you can think about that in contrast to, you know, the history of very frequent and what's evolved to a very dilutive place when it comes to equity issuances. So we've seen a real evolution here. We think management teams, by and large, have drank the Kool-Aid on this, and we think the space is well positioned to perform from here, both fundamentally and structurally. The fund we speak of here is MIE, Cohen & Steers MLP Income and Energy Opportunity Fund, shown on slide 18. Leverage, again, these numbers are as of November 30th, as they were for the infrastructure fund. 30% leverage, 85% fixed with a three-year term. The yield, almost 10% on NAV. And with that, I will turn it back to Michelle.
Okay, great. Thank you, Ben. All right, now is a good time to pose questions for Doug and Ben if you haven't done so already. As a reminder, you could submit questions through the sidebar on the presentation page titled Ask a Question, or email them to questions@capitallinkwebinars.com. And while we wait for a couple questions to come in, as a reminder, page 19, so the last page of the presentation prior to the appendix, lists all 9 of Cohen & Steers' closed-end fund offerings. And if you'd like more information on those funds or the asset classes that we talked about today, feel free to please visit our website, www.cohenandsteers.com. You can also call 1-800-330-7348 for more information. And if you do go to our website, if you click on Insights at the top horizontal navigation row, then Education, and then Closed End Fund Knowledge Center, there's a great deal of educational resource information on closed end funds that we hope you'll find useful. Okay, so now let's take a look and take some questions. So let's see. So first question would be for Doug. Is now a good time, in your opinion, to invest in closed end funds?
I guess the short answer is that our view is that the closed-end fund market is always serving up bargains, and that the key is to be selective in your approach to discerning where you can find relative value. So we wouldn't say that the entire closed-end fund market is on sale or that the entire closed-end fund market offers value, but we did highlight three parts of the market where we have significant overweight positions. We mentioned that we think that there's a tactical opportunity in municipal closed-end funds with discounts very wide to their long-term average. We mentioned that we felt like the attractive relative value of the underlying asset class in midstream energy focused MLP closed-end funds, both in terms of multiples on cash flow relative to where midstream energy has traded historically, and then looking at the closed-end funds themselves where the current distribution yield relative to its long-term average, the current discount relative to its long-term average also score high. And then and with respect to emerging market equity, where those funds sell at double-digit discounts to net asset value. Where long-term returns in emerging market equity securities are very, very comparable to the S&P 500 over a 30-year basis, and those securities have lagged U.S.-focused securities significantly historically. So we think they're bargains to be found, but that the key is selectivity.
Okay, great. Thank you. Next question would be for Ben. Many research firms have recently produced favorable research on midstream energy targeting double-digit return potential. Do you think that is warranted possible?
We do. And in fact, obviously, we've seen quite a bounce this year. I mean, clearly, late last year, we saw a precipitous decline in midstream energy as an asset class in terms of performance and valuations getting back to a place that we haven't seen since 2016. So I would say clearly the points I outlined earlier support significant returns from these levels, even with the bounce that we've seen earlier this year. Again, these are improved structures for midstream energy where there's better alignment of management teams, companies, and shareholders or limited partners in the form of MLPs specifically. You've got fundamental tailwinds, which are driving the space to have growing DCF in a way that they haven't really had over the last couple of years. We are substantially through the restructuring, so we think the chances of further distribution cuts across the space for the core group of companies are minimal. So we think that there's a significant momentum. And if you take a look at just the either it's a price to DCF multiple or a cash flow multiple, traditional EV to EBITDA, midstream's trading at a two-turn discount to a reasonable historical average. And that alone to us suggests double-digit upside of the space. If you layer in a view on sort of tangible asset value for the assets owned by midstream companies, some of which can be easily identified through actual data points from private market participants that are buying these assets, again, we think there's at least 20% upside to the space to those asset values. So, yes, we're confident in the midstream space on valuation as we begin 2019 here.
Okay, thank you. A couple of follow-up questions that have come in also related to midstream and our closed-end funds related to tax. So this is the first would be, for those Cohen & Steers closed-end funds that invest in MLPs, which ones issue a 1099 versus a K-1?
All of our closed-end funds issue 1099s, so no K-1s.
Okay. The second part of that question is, if the closed-end fund issues a K-1, is it suitable for a retirement account or a taxable account?
I'd say not applicable because we're all 1099s.
Correct. Okay. And if the closed-end fund invests in MLPs and issues a 1099, what are the costs, tax or otherwise, of the convenience of not getting that K-1?
So that's a little bit of a complicated question. I guess the way I think about that is I don't have the exact cost numbers offhand in terms of the amount that one would be saving from internalizing the K-1 administrative expense, which would be something that we would handle within the fund structure, versus you getting a K-1 through some kind of an SMA as an investor, getting a bunch of K-1s and having to spend on the accountant bills to accommodate those K-1s. So I don't have the exact number for you. What I would say is we as an institution internalize that cost and are not that's something that you are not having to manage on your own in a way that you'd have to if you're receiving K-1s for the products.
Okay. Another one for you, Ben. Compare relative and absolute value of MLPs today versus January 2016.
Yeah, so if you look at the level of the AMZ, which is the call it the benchmark for midstream energy and specifically MLPs. Roughly the same level today, and it's bounced a little bit from being at the same level a couple of weeks ago as it was in 2016. I'd say today cash flows are a little bit stronger, but I'd say that the big difference here is the environment that we're in. So multiples are probably similar. Valuations are probably similar to what we saw then, but a completely different environment. And that relates, again, to the simplifications. We think corporate structures are better, or our structures are better. Some of that relates to transitions to a corporate structure. Some of it relates to the retention of the MLP structure, but with improved governance around it. Some of it relates to improved fundamentals. So structural improvements, fundamental tailwinds at a time when we were facing very strong fundamental headwinds in 2016 make us much more optimistic about midstream energy than we were in 2016 when we were at similar valuation levels.
Great, thank you. All right, this next question would be for Doug. Most closed-end funds use leverage. How much of the drop in prices is due to increasing costs of leverage?
Leverage is an important topic when you think about closed-end funds, because three-quarters of all of the funds in the marketplace use leverage in the capital structure in order to amplify the amount of current income that can get delivered to shareholders, as well as the total return opportunity. It's hard to put a precise number on in a given year or over a given time period, how much of a closed-end fund's price drop is attributable to the fact that the borrowing cost for the fund has risen during the course of the year. What I would say about 2018 is that the most illustrative example of rising borrowing costs influence on investment performance is the Muni group of closed-end funds, where most Muni closed-end funds finance using short-term forms of borrowing. Muni borrowing costs were going up during 2018. That was causing most of the Muni closed-end funds in the market to announce dividend cuts throughout the year. And for most of the year, the Muni closed-end funds were down anywhere in the range of 5 to 10%. And some of the biggest drops in their market prices was occurring subsequent to unexpected or unexpectedly large distribution cuts. But as we got to the end of the year, actually, the funds that had done well for sort of the first 6, 7, 8 months of the year, the equity group of funds, performed really poorly. And I would say that that had less to do with the fact that equity funds were using borrowing in their capital structure in order to amplify total return opportunities, and more to do with investor concerns about decelerating global and domestic growth prospects, as well as, you know, some focus in the back half of the year on the prospects of continued Fed tightening, which is really not a function of what had occurred to that point in terms of rising borrowing costs for those funds. It was more about expectations. And as it turned out, the best performing of the three major closed-end fund groups as we got to the end of the year was actually the funds, the municipal closed-end funds, which exhibited the closest linkage for much of the year between rising borrowing costs and poor performance.
Thank you. All right, one last question that I want to make sure we answer from our audience. Please discuss large return of capital distributions in your funds, particularly in FOF.
I guess what I would say is that every year FOF provides its shareholders with a 1099, which enumerates the return characteristics of the total distributions paid to shareholders. So $1.04 annual rate, and it breaks down that $1.04 in terms of ordinary income, QDI, return of capital, a percent of the total distributions that are attributable to ownership of municipal closed-end funds so that they have a tax-exempt characteristic. The actual return of capital percentages have been relatively low for FOF historically, and they really reflect our ownership of underlying closed-end funds. So I would say that that hasn't, it generally has not been the case that a significant percentage of FOF's distributions have been attributable to return of capital.
Okay. Thank you very much to Doug and Ben, and many thanks to our partner, Capital Link. And thank you to all who listened in and participated today. We recognize we have many Cohen & Steers asset holders on the line with us, and we're grateful for the trust that you place in us and appreciate your time and interest today. Have a great day.